Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vonta. If you're building a SaaS business, achieving compliance with SOC 2, ISO 27001, or other in-demand frameworks can unlock major growth for your company and establish customer trust. However, this process is often time-intensive and costly. Vonta automates your compliance work, getting you audit ready quickly and saving you up to 85% of associated costs. And Vonta scales with your business, helping you continuously monitor compliance, unify risk management, and streamline security reviews. Join 8,000 global companies like Synethia, Flow Health, and Alica Bank that use Vonta to build trust and prove security in real time. Our audience gets a special offer of $1,000 off Vonta at vonta.com/EU startups. That's vonta.com/EU startups.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My next guest is Gerard Gregg, the Managing Director of Founders at the University of Cambridge, a new strategic initiative focused on accelerating the formation and scaling of new deep technology-based companies. Gerard is also the founder and former chief executive of TechNation, before it was acquired by the Founders Forum Group. Gerard, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So Gerard, let's dive right into it. You've worked across, different places. Let's name it. Like New York, London, Paris. And we talked about the cities a bit before we got on air. What's the one city that's getting it right for startups and why?
I think all three cities offer something unique, obviously, to startups, right? But I think I would say, and I'm not being biased here, but London, I think, brings something unique in the sense that you've got the regulatory institutions based here. You've got a lot of capital based here. Over 250 international banks are based here. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you've got a lot of great universities, which attracts people who may then go on to stay and start a business. So you've got a number of things coming together into a very neat proposition. It's obviously English speaking, and the time zone aspect is very good for people having calls with the United States as well as Southeast Asia, in particular Singapore or China or Japan. So there's a number of things going for London, in my opinion, for startups. And when it comes to venture capital, I think it is still the case that over 70% of all European venture capital somehow flows through London. Mm. So that's always a good thing. And also, finally, I would say that the London Stock Exchange, the third or fourth largest in the world when it comes to the number of companies listed, is a very good way of keeping that in mind as you start your business, that you have access to coaches, advisors, and people who have done this before multiple times to give you that kind of push and boost. And that's a lot. There's a lot of expertise here, I would say. But that's to say that New York is obviously a very strong global financial capital. Paris is doing amazing things. So, I'm positive about all three nonetheless.
Awesome. Gerard, what are the key differences between European and the US startup ecosystems? Like, what's holding Europe back from creating more global tech giants, and how to fix it? Do you have a magic formula?
Yes, I think, and perhaps what I will say is probably not that surprising to many of your listeners, but I think this was reflected in Draghi's recent report on the European ecosystem. But I would say that the US ecosystem, particularly Silicon Valley, because it is a cluster in itself, has just a more risk-tolerant investment culture. Mm-hmm. And they're just more willing to take bold, disruptive risks and put large sums of capital in. I would say, in contrast, Europe is perhaps at times, it is changing, too focused on traction and sustainable growth versus big picture ambition. Yeah. And another one I would say, and this is not something that can change overnight, which is the fact that you have got a fragmented market. When I was working at Orange, France Telecom, Nokia, we were constantly thinking about how to, and I was deploying products and services across multiple countries where you had to deal with different languages, different cultures, different types of managerial systems and so different payment systems. Mm-hmm. That is getting easier and it will get easier and easier. But I think to your point about, fixing certain aspects of the European ecosystem, which is getting better, is perhaps more patient capital, a shift towards more risk tolerance, and perhaps a more unified regulatory framework. I think that would be helpful. But just, I think I would say finally, I mean, really, it is come down to attitude. Just believing with more conviction in our founders that are coming out of our universities. There are some of the best, very best universities are in Europe. And that's a fact. And that's not going to change overnight.
True. Jared, but who do you think is lacking the conviction? Is it the founders themselves or the investors and the government?
I think the investors are one piece of the pie. Government, secondly. I mean, there's no particular order to what I'm saying here, but yeah, it's just a general culture and also big corporates taking more, looking at more early stage stuff and being better at scouting out emerging founders coming out of the university and just backing and championing innovation rather than just doing more things in the way that we've been doing them. So I think perhaps, and I'm coming from a slightly biased view in the sense of my experience, is that we shouldn't just be focused on incremental innovation. We really ought to be really focused on disruptive innovation, which will take bold bets. And I think this is where I think the UK government in particular took a bold bet with ARIA, the Advanced Research and Invention Agency, an £800 million agency that's looking to make many, many, many small bets on things which are on paper look quite far-fetched, but actually could really transform in how society around us works. So how do you get people in all constituents of an ecosystem to believe more in people who have perhaps bold and weird ideas? And you have that in bags in Silicon Valley. I was on a weekly basis commuting to Silicon Valley, and just the conversations you would have, it was just that no idea was a bad idea. And the ambition never stopped at the Valley, at the US. It was just truly global in mindset. Amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's what I've heard as well. Actually, why I asked, because there was this notion that I oftentimes got, that, European founders tend to be a bit more grounded as opposed to founders from the US coming and having these bold visions and strong conviction they're going to execute, that they can actually change the world with their solution. And then, let's talk about Tech Nation. Tech Nation's impact was huge. What's the biggest lesson you took from building Europe's top digital ecosystem?
I think working with government was fantastic, and because I was really on a mission to change people's perception that government does play a role and has a role to play in creating ecosystems. Because I think when you work at the extremes of capitalism, a lot of people might think, governments don't really have a role to play in creating new valuable companies. So there was a sort of a part in me that was sort of very much driven by changing perceptions to that. And I have to say that it was a pleasure to work with that government, even though we went through so many political changes. But it was also awkward at times. But I think my biggest lesson I took is that of Tech Nation is that the power of community and collaboration and the power of government overall was very, very strong, given that our ROI in the end was 20x. So that means that for every pound that the state was putting in, the state was getting £20 back, and that's contributed $1 billion of contribution, actual added contribution, net contribution to the economy. And just the power of bringing founders together creating conditions in which they were able to share their issues of the day on a constant basis was transformative. So we obviously created programs for the people in the audience that may not be familiar with Tech Nation. Tech Nation was a government-backed initiative that was a private company, however, and it was working with different constituents of the ecosystem, whether it was startups, founders, investors, academics, universities, regulators, you name it, and just being a catalyst for change. And one of the things we did, because we had over 15 product lines, but one of the product lines was just creating growth programs where we used to bring very strong cohorts of companies together. And we facilitated connections. We facilitated the conditions for founders to really talk to other founders and share their challenges and problems in a very safe space. And that was transformative. As I said, in some instances, some people would actually, you know, some CEOs, I wouldn't obviously go around saying this a lot of the time at the time, but I would say that some CEOs used to step down at the end of our programs because we made them see something they were not seeing at the beginning as a leader, which is if you really truly want to scale a company successfully, you've got to be truly honest with yourself as a leader, which is then gets reflected as a team and as a company. And so we were doing things that were perhaps not being done as much in the market, in the private market, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what did Tech Nation do differently that helped tech, you know, spread beyond London to other UK cities? Like,
yes, I mean, I'd say probably three things in particular. One is the cohort-based learning and the notion. I think we were one of the first in Europe to really put these together in the way that we did for the digital companies. Because Future 50 in the end, I think, was the longest and most successful late-stage program for digital companies in Europe, with over $30 billion raised collectively between the companies. But secondly, I would say to your point and your question, I think Tech Nation made a very conscious decision to embed itself in regional ecosystems and creating local hubs and building relationships with city leaders and local tech communities across the UK. And we made the programs very accessible over time. It wasn't overnight to anybody from across the UK. Because obviously, capital cities like London are very good at attracting ambitious people. And there's always a bit of a brain drain that goes from towns and cities into capital cities. And we were trying to reverse that with a real passionate mission to say, actually, it doesn't matter where you are, you have the access to the skills and tools that you need to become successful exactly where you are. Because if that's the case, then you as an individual, if you are successful in a place like Edinburgh or Manchester, people locally in those local populations look up to that person, he or she, or the team as a co-founding team, and say, well, if they can do it, I can do it here. I don't need to move. And I think there's a lot to be said about that, because obviously we live in a very globalist society now where people move around, but actually there's a lot to be said about local economies and local communities
and local role models, right?
And I think we really tried, you know, we obviously it's still going now. Obviously Founders Forum are doing an amazing job with continuing many of the things we started and doing a fantastic job at that. And I think what we always did at Tech Nation was to really do big picture thinking by connecting the dots from the grassroots up, which government could never do. And I think we were, a great team, an intermediary team between government and the way it looked at the world and startup founders and the way that they looked at the world. They're very different civilizations. They're very different. They have very different ways of working. Yeah. And we were kind of encoding and decoding the communication between those two different groups.
Gerard, a third of UK unicorns came from Tech Nation's programs. It just shows the impact. How did you identify those early winners?
So we had judging panels. So in total, we did 1,300 companies, just for clarity. And we did 48 growth programs by 2023. They've now been obviously relaunched in a different with Founders Forum, but we identified 42 unicorns in that process, And
crazy.
I think the judging was composed of experts in their respective fields. And we used to have very heated debates about who we allowed in, and it wasn't quota based. We were really very selective in who we thought were good to come onto the program. We also looked at the selection criteria was obviously of a certain type. You had to have raised or was turning over a certain amount of money or was growing at a certain rate, because in some instances there were companies that were product first and not making money yet. But we looked at founders who were obsessive and really keen to go on a continuous learning journey. They were not fixed in their mindset and coachable. Yeah. And then a big part, actually, to your question was referrals, because once you get the formula right, I'm not saying that it was a formula every time. If people had value from it, they're going to recommend it to the next founder they're going to meet. And obviously, founders trust other founders. It's a fact. Yeah. In fact, we had to get that right. And we were driven by NPS all the time and constantly looking at how to make these programs better and better and better based on their feedback. And we tried to emulate the behaviors of a scaling company. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, contributed to getting some things right. I wouldn't say we've got it right every time.
Yeah. Jared, speaking of scaling, what's the biggest mistake startups make when scaling?
I think too often, and we slightly did it ourselves, I think, because we were scaling, we got to over 110 people at peak, if not more. Basically, you scale too fast without strong operational foundations in place. Mm-hmm. And I think you can sometimes expand too quickly, especially when you've been given an injection of capital at Series A, Series B. These are big, big injections of capital. And you start to enter new markets too soon, and you start to launch products too quickly without really having done enough testing or at least consumer validation or customer validation. So, and sometimes in some instances, the business model isn't quite sustainable as first thought. So, and then secondly, this is much earlier, I would say, that I kept on seeing repeatedly, is the lack of focus on culture and getting that right. So you would get very driven founders, but it's not just about the founders. It's about the fact that you are creating as leaders the conditions for the company to scale. So you need to focus on the culture that then builds the machine that then becomes successful.
Got it. Jared, let's talk about your current role. What sets Cambridge apart from other university-driven tech ecosystems?
Yes, and I think, look, I don't want to be biased because I live in London, I commute up to Cambridge, and I was thinking, is this a path I want to take? And I started looking at the statistics and the data. I'm very data-driven in that regard. And I started to think, wow, actually, when you look at Cambridge's history, it's phenomenal, right? The invention of the jet engine, IVF, DNA, even the early days of computer gaming in the 1950s came out of Cambridge. And you're thinking, wow, this story after story, Nobel Prize after Nobel Prize. In fact, they have the highest share of Nobel Prizes ever in the history. So I think 21% of Nobel Prizes come from Cambridge. And then I started to look at the data from a venture capital perspective and the amount of investment going in. And it was third in the world for scientific output. And when you look at the patents, the value of the patents, the exits, and the breakout capital that was going into companies. And then I started looking at it and I started to think, actually, what you do have in Cambridge that perhaps is not necessarily the case in many other university towns is that you have a strong pool of executive talent that really knows how to scale a company right up to IPO and beyond. And that's not easy to find. Secondly, you've also got investors that really know and understand deep technology and what it takes to de-risk science, to de-risk the capital, de-risk the product at the early stages. Obviously, Cambridge University attracts over $1 billion of research each year. And that manifests itself into about 30 billion pounds of contribution to the economy. Mm-hmm. And then obviously you've got dozens and dozens of learning programs, and all about enabling or at least facilitating researchers and academics to take more risk. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it, academics are driven by rigor. And rigor definitely comes from experimentation, but with a sole result in mind. When you're dealing with entrepreneurship, you are dealing with so many unknowns, and you have to have the confidence to be very risk tolerant. And so the combination of that academic rigor and through learning, and so there are many pathways that are made available within Cambridge, which is so good at this, so that people can take risk. It's all about baby steps and de-risking the way in which you look at the world. So I think that, for me, is what's, I think, cuts Cambridge above the rest in many cases in Europe and the world, I would say. I think
you're
Boston
providing this kind of at the earliest stages, like this kind of safety net that people can be in a comfortable position enough to take the biggest bets and biggest risks, right? Because I just wanted to ask again, how can university affiliated ecosystems accelerate the scaling of startups beyond research? Because this is a problem at many universities, I think.
Well, create new pathways or at least improve existing pathways, mm-hmm. and create bridges, surface the best people for investors to take a look at.
Yeah.
And so incubators, accelerators, advisors, networks of coaches, but not just any coaches, but people who've really honestly taken a deep technology company and scaled it. It's not the same as a digital company. And to your earlier question, actually, this is what's changing.
Yeah.
I think we're reaching a maturization of digital ecosystems. Uh-huh. The new wave of value creation is going to come out of the marriage of physical systems and digital systems, especially to solve things like climate change. You cannot solve that through use of software only. It's just impossible. So physical science, advanced materials, and combining that. So you've got a lot of chemists, and if you combine chemists and make them meet people who know how to do product management and product marketing, so that investors can take a look and think about the fact that there might be an opportunity here. Bringing those aspects and those constituents together in a much more constructive way is how universities could do a better job of making it easier for investors to step in and say, okay, I'll take the risk and do this. Mm. So, and governments, as you know, are looking at this very seriously because of the growth opportunity, given that we are, you know, growth around Europe is really plateauing to some extent. It's not the levels that it was in the 1980s and 1990s. Mm-hmm. So how do we bring more capital in so that the people putting the money in might have tax-efficient ways of relieving themselves from the risk they're taking, but also know that these companies can then get acquired, there is a pathways for their acquisition, and there is a potential listings so that the investors can then make their money and then reinvest it in the next wave of pioneers and founders, and get that flywheel effect a lot more going, a lot more with greater momentum.
Uh-huh. Jaron, how do you see, what role do you see for AI in this? How do you envision AI transforming not only tech companies but the educational institutions that are breeding tomorrow's innovators?
I guess it won't surprise you to say absolutely huge. And because when you start to combine AI with new computational power like quantum computing, there's just absolutely no doubt that the speed of discovery of new things and really piercing through boundaries of our own human imagination is just going to accelerate. And it's going to really accelerate. when quantum computing is here. So whether it's research development into drug development, you know, so if you take a company like Helix, for example, which is a Cambridge-based company, they are on the hunt for they are looking for solutions to very rare diseases that naturally a lot of money has not gone into rare diseases because the opportunity is not so big. But because of AI, that is now an opportunity. And Helix is actually looking at the solutions through the use of AI. They've raised over $100 million to do this. So I think that's going to be quite transformative. And obviously with predictive analytics of what could come next and multinomic sequencing in the therapeutic space, just the use of AI is going to be central and integral to that. And obviously then with the fact that the students, researchers, postdocs, professors leveraging AI to find faster solutions to problems they're solving. So I think overall, quite transformative, but also a huge acceleration in time.
Amazing. Jared, what is the biggest lesson you've learned about leadership and scaling from your time at Tech Nation that you are now sharing with founders at Cambridge?
Wow. I mean, I was very privileged to be working with such amazing people like Tom Bloomfield, who was the co-founder of Monzo, and Go Cardless, and many others like himself, Will Shu from Deliveroo. I mean, they came through some of our programs. It was just such a privilege, and I never took it for granted. And it was just always amazing to sort of learn from these people. But I think one thing that I did probably learn is the need to be open to feedback from your team and be decisive. Obviously, from stating the obvious of having a vision and being able to clarify and communicate that vision as a CEO, I would say that the culture really does make a huge difference to a company's success. And even if you look at a company like Arm, which is now in over 90% of our smartphones, that started in Cambridge. There's a book recently written about how the culture basically made that company so successful. I think it's called Culture One, which is quite interesting. But I think what I mean by culture is empowering people to figure things out for themselves rather than sort of giving instructions and being able to know when to delegate, to trust and nurture talent. And that comes with experience. It comes with time. It comes with making mistakes. You know, there's many times I made mistakes as a chief executive, and there needs to be some humility to that and just say, actually, yeah, I think we'll just do better next time. And now, where I am now, I'm just making sure that I'm giving as many opportunities as possible to the team and being a servant leader, I guess, in that regard. But that was consistently the case, actually, when I look back and think about those 42 unicorns, and obviously not, they were successful for good reasons, and they really cared. The people in the teams really cared, and that's because the culture made a difference to their ability to execute. Because after all, it's all about execution. It's about flawless execution.
Gerard, I absolutely love it. I absolutely loved having you on the show. I could talk to you for hours. This was one of the most insightful podcast interviews that I've had. Thank you so much for your time. It was such a pleasure. I hope to see you soon in person to continue the conversation, and I wish you all the best.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and please continue what you're doing. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much, Gerard.